This is A Story of Sorts, the podcast mostly about bookish stuff. And I am your host, Karina Pereira.
Hello, everyone.
On this episode, I chat with Arya Narvar about her debut novel, A Girl Called Rumi, Arya's work dancing with refugees to heal trauma, and her experience migrating from Iran to the USA as a child refugee. Have a listen. Arya, welcome to A Story of Sorts.
Thank you so much, Karina, for having me.
Tell us a bit about yourself. Who is Ari?
I would say that Ari is a moving target. And right now, she is a dancer. So I don't know, a few years ago, dancing became a serenity prayer for me, a zikr of sorts, where it invites me to pivot and flow with what I cannot control. It reminds me to summon every part of me to what I must change, not leaving anything small or trivial behind. And it also points me toward the stillness from which movements arise and music emanates.
That is so poetic. It's such a poetic response. I love it.
Oh, thank you.
Since with that response, you are the founder of Rumi with a View, and I'd really love for you to tell our listeners about your project.
Yes, Rumi with a View is dedicated to building music and poetry bridges across war-torn and conflict-ridden borders. So much of this is dedicated to building bridges. I have a Drop Poems, Not Bombs project where American musicians learn a line of Persian classic poetry in Farsi and put it to their own music and then sing it as a love letter to the people of Iran. And this is because the U.S. doesn't have diplomatic relations with Iran, so we're creating our own cultural bridges. And these musicians are so talented and so beautiful. Like they do Rumi and Hafez, and they do in rap and bluegrass and classical and opera, and it's just gorgeous. It's a gorgeous project. And then the other thing I have is a Rumi's Gift Oracle card and set, and it's Rumi's poems turned into images using Persian calligraphy. And it's kind of a bridge between the Western tarot and the Middle Eastern art of divination that has been part of my culture for thousands of years. We usually do Rumi's poetry, Hafez poetry with divination, but this is I've made Rumi because I connected with him more at this point of my life. So and then I dance with refugees as part of bridge building, humanizing refugees to a larger audience and also welcoming them.
I was actually going to ask you about that because I found the oracle and I thought it was so cool. Did you also design it?
I did, yeah. So I started with just turning the Farsi words into images as paintings. And then people are like, well, what does it say? And then I started translating. So the painting came before the translation and the meditation. And then I met with another wonderful artist, Carmen Costello, who is just, I loved her work. And I said, do you want to collaborate? And so about half of those images are collaborations between the two of us. And she sadly passed away this year. But her work lives on.
For sure. I will set a link for the Oracle gift because I thought it was really cool. Just the whole concept. It's with the drawings and the language, just very fascinating. You are a writer and a journalist. How did that turn into you working with music and poetry and refugees? I'd really love to learn about your journey.
Yeah, so I didn't begin my career as a writer till very recently. I'm in school, I studied molecular biology, and in graduate school, I was doing cancer research, and I got hired out by Nikon microscope division. So I was like doing technical stuff and working with researchers at universities and different research settings. So, you know, writing or music and all of this never really came to me until much more recently. And what happened was that I joined Musical Ambassadors of Peace about 5 years ago. And they're an organization that is, their mission is very much aligned with mine, with creating musical bridges across war-torn borders. So I was like, let's do this. So they, when Syrian refugees started coming here at the height of the Syrian war, I asked what I could do, and they told me to start a drum and dance circle. And I, at the time, I was like, well, this is what hippies do in Berkeley, right? You know, drum circles. How is this going to help victims of war, you know? And then the more I learned about it, I understood what an amazing, and dancing has been such a huge part of my own healing too, but just drumming and dancing is so good for anxiety, depression, you know, and releasing trauma, and just being in community is such a supportive system. So I've witnessed so many miraculous incidents as we were doing this with people who had been through horrible things, kids, women, children, and men. So then I, after the Muslim ban happened in and no more people from Middle East started to come, newcomers, I shifted my focus to the crisis at the U.S.-Mexico border, which was very much, you know, an issue, and they were separating kids from their parents at the time, and I started as a journalist. I was, you know, reporting on that and seeing how awful and traumatic this was for people who were just trying to survive. They didn't even want a better life; they just wanted to live. And so I brought my drum and dance sessions to Tijuana, Mexico, and I began doing weekly sessions. And it was so popular that when pandemic happened and we couldn't go anywhere, they're like, we still want to dance. How can we do this? So I'm doing Zoom dance sessions weekly still from my home. And I dance with the refugee shelter in Tijuana.
Do you think that experience also helped you write A Girl Called Rumi? And because it does have that sense of how stories, how stories can change people and heal people in such different ways, even though sometimes they feel like such a small thing. They're just stories.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, the arts are such a powerful means of transformation. So without stories, we would be nothing. I think there is a line, even the storyteller in A Girl Called Rumi says something like, whoever doesn't love stories doesn't love God, you know, or that's what his teacher told him, because it's just this God is to him, you know, and God is such a nebulous term to him anyways, but but he talks about how God is the best storyteller of all, and that's a part of us that is also that.
A Girl Called Rumi is your debut novel, which came out on the 21st of September. Could you reveal a bit of the story to us?
Yeah, so this story begins on a square where this storyteller is, with music and shadow puppets, is beginning to tell a story of this mythical creature, the Simorgh. And Kimia, the 9-year-old protagonist, is so beguiled and fascinated by the Seymour anyways, and then sees this, and she's on her way to buy naan for dinner, and she completely abandons her mission and just is transfixed by this story. And later we learn that she's an adult in San Diego, and she just has collided with a mysterious huge bird in her mother's garage, and she's knocked down to the ground. And this is a flashback to her childhood in war-torn Iran.
There is a specific story or a passage in the book that then I read that was inspired by something that happened to you as a child. And that's the story of your brother, if I'm not mistaken, hiding a horse in the basement.
Yeah.
How does that happen? How do you hide a horse from the whole family in the basement?
Yeah. So the context is that we lived in almost wilderness. There was a few houses around us, but overall there was plenty of space, and there were villages around. So we had this basement that didn't have stairs, but it was inclined, so you could actually park a car in that inclined area of the basement, in the entrance to the basement. And so so it was separate from the house.
Mm-hmm.
And at night he bought a horse, and we would ride it all day, and then he brought it to my sister and I would distract our parents, and mm-hmm. he would bring the horse in. And then before they woke up, we would take it out or wait for them to go to work and take it out and ride it again and clean after it and stuff.
That is just amazing. Like, of all the stories in the book, just the fact that then you get to the end of the book and then you get this information that this was actually based on a real fact.
I know. It was so funny because my copy editor, she's like, well, if you want it to be, if you're going to go into this, you got to make sure that people understand that it's your imagination, it's your fantasy. I'm like, no, this actually happened. You know, it's like, there's no way this happened.
It's like the most unbelievable thing is actually the thing that happened.
Exactly. Yeah.
When you were 14, you also made the journey from Iran to the USA. And some of that journey was made all by yourself. Would you like to talk about that experience?
Yes. So again, a little bit of background. When I was six, women of Iran lost their right to ride a bicycle or sing in public. And just as this war on women was becoming our new normal, Saddam Hussein attacked Iran and started a war that lasted 8 years and took countless lives. So there were people who were trying to escape all around. And the situation was so tense that a door would slam and people would have heart attacks because this is, we were attacked, assaulted by the bombs. And then also there was an internal war going on, and a war on joy, a war on our coping mechanisms, because we couldn't sing or dance or express our freedom in any way. So then people would just take extraordinary measures to get out of the country. Like smugglers would tell people to run and take them to the Iran-Turkey border and tell them to run in a zigzag pattern in case they were shot, then, there would be a less of a chance that they would die. So this is how terrible it was. And so my mom had an idea. She's a poet, and she wrote a poem to India's ambassador for India's Independence Day. And she said a prayer and put that in along with her visa, our visa application to India, because no country would give us any kind of asylum or refuge. It was just very difficult. And so the Indian ambassador liked the poem, must have liked it, because he gave a visa to myself, my father, and my mother to go to India. And then we secured meeting with the American consulate there. And I was miraculously given a visa to come to the U.S. My parents brought me to the U.S., but they had to go back because my sister was still in Iran. So at the age of 14, I was here not knowing a language or how this strange planet worked. And I was without my parents and my sister as well.
So that there is a lot about your own life and what you remember of your life that served as inspiration to the book, because the protagonist's mother is also a poet.
Yes.
How was your adaptation to the USA?
It was hard. I was very homesick, and that just one of those sink or swim situations that I knew that I couldn't go back. So I had to survive this life without cut off from my roots, from everyone and everything that I loved. My brother, who I hadn't seen for 10 years because of the whole war broke out when he left US, and then he couldn't come back, and then we didn't see each other. I ended up living with him. So it was a complete anthropological experiment of two siblings who hadn't known each other before, all of a sudden are thrown in together. So, but we made it work, and music and dancing really helped me. And that's one of the reasons I'm bringing that to other refugees.
Do you still visit Iran?
I haven't. There is actually a scene in the book when I was interrogated by the last time I visited for hours, and they took my passport, and I was sure they were going to take me to jail. These two men who, just told me to come and, into this office. And they asked me questions over and over again. And this is way before I became a journalist or started writing anything. So I didn't know why I was there, but I also knew how random these kinds of acts of harassment and terror are. And sometimes, you just get on the wrong day, on the wrong person, and you end up in jail or worse. So, the next time we went, I was with my mom. I wasn't alone. And she really got so ferocious with these two agents, and she just wouldn't let them. She's like, "What do you want? What do you want from us? We came after yours to visit our country, there's no reason you're taking her, and we're not going." So she started walking away. So, and I wrote about something similar to that in the book.
Yeah. It's just like, you know what? Not today.
Yeah. Exactly.
Of course, it must be truly frustrating. And I think immigrants kind of like, of course, in different ways, obviously, but immigrants always experience things in which they know that the only reason they are being treated a certain way is because they are immigrants.
This was especially painful because we were going back to our own country, and we were treated like, worse than, foreigner, worse than anything. I mean, not that foreigners should be treated any differently, but yeah, just with so much harassment and not at all welcoming attitude.
Do you ever feel kind of, not, I wouldn't say stuck, but like in between cultures, that there is like a place? Because I do think, if I'm not mistaken, that you speak about it in your book, and it's something that I feel as well. It's like, I wouldn't go back to Portugal now, but I know I will never feel completely 100% like I belong to the Netherlands, but I also don't feel like I belong to Portugal anymore. And of course, like the circumstances in which you had to leave Iran were different. But do you sometimes kind of feel a bit lost in between cultures and the place where you are?
Definitely that feeling of that, yeah, no, that's not where I would fit best. And then no, here is just not quite right either. So that does arise. But again, you know, I'm a dancer, so I'm dancing among lovers, and I'm feeling at home wherever I am when I'm dancing with people who love me so fiercely, and I love them. So that happens wherever I am. I do find people who I can really feel at home with.
That's super nice. When we were exchanging emails for this interview, you pointed out that the Netherlands was one of your first choices to move to. And now I want to know, because we have some people listening from the Netherlands, I want to know why. What pulls you to the country?
Yes, that beautiful Netherlands. First of all, I think it's the bikes more than anything else. I live in California and I hate cars. And I live in Southern California, where there is, in San Diego, there are not viable bike paths. And this is such great weather for biking. You know, 99% of the time you could be biking and it would be, you know, not raining or snowing or anything. And yet we don't have the bike paths. So that's what I was like. And we have one as a family. We're not a two-car family. We've got one car, and that's, we barely, you know, I ride my bike wherever I can. So the biking is definitely one of the main draws. The other one is the work-life balance, which I find that Europe does so much better. I think in the 1950s, Europe just began decreasing the number of hours of work, and in the US just work has just keeps skyrocketing no matter what. And that and even if you're trying not to be in that rat race, if you want to call it that, it still takes effort to remain still and remain slow and remain in your own rhythm. So yeah, the Europe, I think, is so much better. I don't know how, you know, you were just talking about how you worked a lot this week. So I don't know. Maybe I don't have the perfect description of or perception of Netherlands exactly. But I love the caring, the safety net for people that the government takes care of the kids and early education and such. And that's just such a beautiful thing. I think part of a civilization is taking care of our kids and making sure that parents are not completely frazzled. So
I think your intuition or your idea of the country is pretty good. At least, like, I used to live in Belgium, and then I moved to a big city, to Rotterdam, and really cycling to work has improved my life so much, and I get so much joy. And if I told this to myself like 4 years ago, I wouldn't believe it, because I was very much a person who drove a car all the time to go everywhere, to go to work, to go to social gatherings. So just the joy that you get from being outside and from exercising a bit and using a bike as a means of transportation, which can be sometimes, you know, a little bit stressful with other bikers, because there's a lot of bikes here, but most of the, not like traffic, not at all like traffic, is just so healthy and so good for your mind as well. And I also think the balance is really good, even though I worked every single day of this week. But so it's almost full time, but it's still like 38 hours. And it's something that I did because someone was sick. So like the last month, I've been in between, like, changing jobs, and I started a new job. But a lot of people here work like 33 hours or 36. And yeah, and there's a really good balance, because, you know, it's gets to the time that you should stop working. And most of the times, at least from my experience, you stop working and you go home, and or you go out with friends and you do your thing. That's and in wonderful. Portugal, I think maybe the States is a bit like Portugal. Like in Portugal, people kind of expect you to work extra hours, a lot of the times unpaid. And if you don't do, you're not a good worker. So I do think that the balance here is a lot better. So yeah, your idea of the country is correct.
And how many languages do you speak?
Well, yeah, I speak, like, I am a native Portuguese speaker. I speak English and I speak Dutch. And of course, I understand a little bit of Spanish and Italian, because I learned Italian and it's very similar to Portuguese. But here, yeah, at least in the big towns, if you go to Amsterdam, Rotterdam, Utrecht, Den Haag, most people speak English with you. So it can be sometimes a bit frustrating to learn the language because it isn't easy. But a lot of the times, especially if you are involved in projects with community, etc., is English is good enough to build a community and have friends.
Lovely. Yeah. Sounds good.
So just giving you arguments. Let's also talk more about Rumi's poetry, because from what I see, it is a part of a lot of your projects. And how did your story with Rumi's poetry begin?
Yeah, I tell, when people ask me that, when did your relationship with Rumi begin, I say it began long before I was born, because I come from a culture in which poetry is so much part of a person as it could be their heartbeat. We recite poems in celebrations, in conversations, in welcoming sorrow, in even when we're trying to resolve conflicts. And so these poems of Rumi, Saadi, Hafez, Farooq have been part of me, and I've been reciting them before even I could read or write. What happened was, I mean, when I, Shiraz is the home to Hafez and Saadi. And I, at one point, I had memorized a pretty good chunk, if not all of Hafez's poems, because I was so, I loved his poetry so much. And this is when I was a kid, you know, like that's how, you know, you don't see kids be so into poetry, in at least not in the US, but in Iran, it definitely happens. And so when I came to the US, poetry was just basically this vestigial organ that I had no use for. You know, I was just trying to survive, learn English, find, you know, try to get people to not otherize me. And so how do I fit in best? But it was years later, maybe a decade after I arrived in the US, and I just started feeling this tug from a long lost beloved. And I just began reciting Rumi in Farsi, like at gatherings, just totally spontaneously. Mm-hmm. And people didn't say, oh, you've gone crazy. Like, what's going on? What's wrong with you? They were like, oh my God, that sounds so beautiful. Can you translate it for us? So that's how my journey to translation began. But Rumi was a huge part of this, because somehow he, even though I grew up with Hafez and Saadi, who are from my hometown, it was Rumi's poetry that just kept coming back to me when I was trying to integrate my life in the US and my past in Iran.
Did you do the translations for your book yourself?
I did, yes.
And do you ever find, like, sometimes translations, like, that you know the original and you kind of go like, this is just not it?
Oh yeah. A lot of the Rumi translations that are floating around are done by white men who don't speak Farsi.
Oh.
And I think, like, that's a minimum qualification for a translator to know the language from which they're translating from. So I made it my point to translate all my own, all the poems that I have from Iran. And they're not exactly the same as other translators who are from Iran, because translation is just such a personal thing too. Mm-hmm. Depending on where you are in your life, you translate something differently than you would another time. And of course, then when it's between people, it's different. You know, some people are more academic, some people are more playful. So yeah, I'm more kind of like a free flowing, playful with words, and just get the essence and paint a picture from what I see from the poem originals.
When did A Girl Called Rumi start to take shape in your mind? Is this a book you have always wanted to write? Did you imagine that you were going to write it a few years back?
It started 15 years ago when I wasn't even, again, writing was not my thing. I was always an avid reader, but never thought I would write a story. But that's when I met my husband, and he asked me if I wanted to write a screenplay together. When we first met, and I said, I'm not a writer, I don't even know. And so we just started kind of putting together this bones of the story and a screenplay as a love letter to each other. and it became a screenplay, and we entered it into a couple of contests, and it placed in the semifinals or finals, and then we shelved it. And I knew I wanted to incorporate this myth of Seven Valleys of Love, but because I was always so into this mythical creature, the sea morgue. I actually dreamed of the sea morgue when I was a kid all the time. So that was very pivotal in the storytelling, that myth. And then about 2017, I began converting it into a novel and added so much more and changed so much more, so much of the what we had done together.
And now it's out.
And now it's out.
What would you like to achieve with your stories? What is the dream?
To tell a good story is always so satisfying. So I hope I'm able to tell a good story, something that something that honors all states of being, not just focusing on the positive and being joyful, and not just rehashing old traumas, but this, the dance between the joy and the loss, what we yearn for and what we have, that kind of something that presents a dynamic like that.
Are you working on any of the stories at the moment?
Right now I'm working on an audio translations of Rumi as a companion to the Rumi's Gift Oracle cards, and it would have guided meditations put to music. And that's very fun and soothing for me to work on.
Sounds super interesting. As someone who used to rely on guided meditations to fall asleep and stay asleep, that's, yeah, it's it's a gift.
Yeah, I'm definitely enjoying it.
Can people find everything online, what you're working on and when new projects come in?
Yeah, I try to keep up mostly with my website, which is rumiwithaview.com.
Now, this is the last question of the podcast, and I would like to know an all-time favorite book and a book you would recommend right now.
I have a lot of all-time favorite books. So, but what comes to mind right now is The Sirens of Titans, and it's a Kurt Vonnegut Jr. novel that I've read so many times throughout different periods of my life, and it really makes me laugh, and it's about the human condition, and it's really funny and really fun. So that's the one that I would say right now is my favorite. That's what comes to mind. And the one that I would recommend is The Enchanted by Renee Denfeld. She is an incredible writer, and this book is absolutely amazing. And Margaret Atwood also thinks it's amazing. So it's just not just me.
Ari, thank you so much for coming to the podcast.
Oh, thank you for having me. This was very fun.
Thank you.
You can access today's show's notes via my pod page, which you can find along with all of my social media links at linktree.com/Karina Pereira. If you have enjoyed this episode, please consider supporting A Story of Sorts on Patreon. Patreon is a platform which allows you to contribute monthly to the podcast in exchange for extra content, such as early access to episodes, a shout-out at the end of an episode and on Instagram, and choosing a theme for me to talk about on the podcast. You can become a patron at patreon.com/A Story of Sorts. Leaving a review would also be highly appreciated. Don't forget to subscribe to get a notification when the next episode hits. I'll talk to you then, and thank you for listening.